Okay, at any rate, before we start, I want to clarify. Last week, when I was talking about the milk of the word being digested, being pre-digested food, and talking about if it's being pre-digested, you remember what I talked about last week about the milk of the word. Somebody brought to my attention that that could have been interpreted that I was saying that we will, that the mature Christian has no need of other people to teach them. And I want to clarify that and make sure that that's not what everybody heard. Because I was not suggesting at all that we have no need of one another, nor was I suggesting that we have it all together to where we don't need the input and what the revelation that comes through other people. What I was trying to say, and the point that I was trying to get across, was that if all you depend on is what other people have digested for you, you're still a babe. That's what I was, the message that I was trying to get across. So please don't misconstrue that. Somebody brought to my attention that it could have been misconstrued as to mean that we have no need of one another. All right, so please don't hear that in what I was saying last week. All right, thank you.
10 after, good. Cool. Well, the first session tonight, as we continue to look at the question, who am I, is looking at us as the bride of Christ. And we're not going to, I mean, we could go on and on and on with this, but we're not. And we're just going to kind of take a real brief look at it tonight, and then we're going to leave time for an activation at the end. So, but I want to preface what we're going to share tonight with just a couple of things. One is that sometimes we can get confused. I know when I was a young Christian, sometimes I had a hard time. It was like, well, okay, I'm the bride, but I'm a son, but I'm also the body, and I'm also... And I had a hard time sort of gelling all that together. And I thought of an example that might help us if you're having a hard time gelling how we can be all these things at one time and which characteristics go with which thing, you know. But I'll share more about that in just a minute. If you have a hard time gelling all that together in your mind, and it seems a little mind-boggling, think of Dave, for example. and me, all right? We have a relationship, just like we have a relationship with the Lord, right? And in mine and Dave's relationship, we have a relationship as husband and wife. We have a relationship as co-ministers, where we work together. And our relationship as ministers and working together is a little bit different than our relationship as husband and wife, although there is some overlap, right? We also have a relationship together as sort of parents together, which is a whole nother side of our relationship. And so we have these different facets to our relationship, which in some ways are very unique, but in other ways there's a lot of overlap, isn't there? And it's like that in our relationship with God as sons and as his adopted ones and as his bride and as his body and as his temple. And, you know, they're just different facets of our relationship with him. And sometimes we might think about the characteristics. Like some of the things I'm going to talk about tonight, which are characteristic of the bride, you're going to be thinking, but we talked about that last week under sonship. You know, that's sort of the characteristic of the son. Well, yes, but it's also the characteristic of the bride. And so there is some overlap. Just like there's some overlap in mine and Dave's relationship as husband and wife and mine and Dave's relationship as ministers together, there's some overlap in the different facets of our relationship with God as well. So I just wanted to bring some clarity to that so that if there was a little bit of a hard time having that gel in your mind, that that might help a little bit. So we want to go on and look at the concept of the bride tonight. And the first thing you have in your notes is that the bride or wife is a picture of a relationship that God has ordained with him. The Song of Solomon is probably the most striking example in the Old Testament. And the allegorical interpretation of the Song of Solomon, and you need to be aware that there's probably three main types of interpretation of that particular book. All right, some people interpret it literally, some people interpret it sort of halfway literally and halfway allegorically, and then there's the allegorical interpretation. But that interpretation, which was is the one that was always favored by the Jews historically and by leading scholars in modern times. And in this interpretation, it's considered a poem which is descriptive of the love between Jehovah and Israel, this is the Jewish version, or between Christ and the believer, that's the Christian version. The key word through the whole book of the Song of Solomon is beloved. And the key verse is chapter 6, verse 3, which is, I am my beloved's, and he is mine, and my beloved is mine. That's the key verse in the Song of Solomon. And it so beautifully paints the picture of the believer as the bride of Christ, and is his lover and his loved one. Now, the Apostle Paul also used the marriage relationship to teach about the relationship of Christ to his church in two different passages. One is 1 Corinthians 11, verse 3, and the other is Ephesians chapter 5, verses 25 through 33. And then finally, in the book of Revelation, we really see a lot said about the bride, particularly in the final chapters. Now think about this. If we want to look at the importance of the concept of the bride, think about this. What is the culmination of history in the Bible? When you read the Bible, where do you find the culmination of history? Where do you find the final outcome? Where do you find what everything is building up to in the Bible? The book of Revelation, don't you? And the final chapters of the book of Revelation all focus on the church, the New Jerusalem, as the bride of Christ, united with him for eternity. That's the final outcome. That's the culmination of all of history. As we come to the end of time, and time becomes no more, and we step back into eternity, that is the culmination of all of time, is the uniting of the bride with Christ for eternity. Just a couple of verses to just note in your notes that mention this in the book of Revelation. Revelation 19:7 talks about the marriage of the Lamb has come and his wife has made herself ready and are being arrayed in fine linen, which is clean, and that this is the righteous acts of the saints. And then in Revelation 21, verses 2 and 3, he talks about seeing the holy city, the New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven as a bride adorned for her husband. In Revelation 21, verses 9 and 10, he says, come, I'll show you the bride, the Lamb's wife. In Revelation 22, verse 17, the Spirit and the bride say, come, come. And let him who thirsts come, whoever desires, whosoever will, may come. Let him take of the water of life freely. All right. Now, in the Old Testament and the New Testament, we have a little bit of a difference. There's still a picture of a marital kind of relationship, but theologians tend to pretty much agree that the Old Testament portrays Israel as married to the Father. Whereas in the New Testament portrays the church, the redeemed saints, as married to the Son. And another difference is that the wife or the betrothed one in the Old Testament is revealed as being unfaithful, adulterous, and defiled under the law. But the bride of Christ in the New Testament is revealed as clean, washed, a virgin, and righteous. So under the law, the one that God chose to have that spousal relationship was unable to be the kind of bride that God desired. But under grace, and because of the redemption that's been provided on our behalf by God Himself, the bride is able to be pure and righteous and washed and clean. Now, I want to just mention here, and you have a place to just make a note about this, a Hebrew custom, which sheds some interesting light on this whole concept of bridehood in the New Testament, okay? The Hebrew custom was that the betrothed parties were legally in the position of a married couple. Once they were betrothed, they were legally in the position of a married couple. An unfaithfulness in the period between the betrothal and the consummation of the marriage was considered adultery, just as if they'd been married for years. And you might want to check these verses. I haven't actually looked them up, so... But one is Deuteronomy 22, verse 23, and Matthew chapter 1, verse 19. Now, the marriage ceremony and the marriage supper, Deuteronomy 22, verse 23, and Matthew 1, verse 19. Okay. Now, the marriage ceremony and the marriage supper and all of those things were simply concluding festivities for something that was already a done deal. All right? So to summarize this, is once they were betrothed, they were married for all practical purposes. It just hadn't been consummated yet. All right? Now, how this applies to us. We're betrothed to Him. As soon as we receive Him into His heart, into our heart, and we are baptized into the body of Christ and become one of His own, then we become betrothed to Him. And when that happens, we're not only betrothed, but in a very legal sense, we're married already. It just hasn't been consummated. And the rest of what's coming is just the concluding festivities. Now, Scripture reinforces this conclusion. When Jesus called himself the bridegroom and John the Baptist called him the bridegroom, the Greek word used is one which refers to a newly married man. In other words, it refers to a bridegroom who's just become married, not the bridegroom who isn't married yet. And so they both specifically used the word that refers to a newly married man who's a bridegroom. And so we're not just the bride, but for all practical purposes, we're married. And it just, we haven't reached the concluding festivities yet, which we will at the marriage supper of the Lamb. All right. Now, I just want to give you a few scriptures here to jot down under the Old Testament. These are just some of the places where God referred to Israel as a wife or a spouse. One is Jeremiah chapter 3, verse 20, where he said, "Surely as a wife treacherously departs from her husband, so have you treacherously dealt with me." Jeremiah 31, verse 32 is another one where he says, "I was a husband to you." Ezekiel chapter 16, verse 32 is another one where he calls her an adulterous wife. Ezekiel chapter 16, verse 32. And then Hosea 2, verse 16. He speaks of the coming day when they would actually call him their husband. All right, now in the New Testament, with the relationship between Jesus and the church as the bride and the bridegroom, we find that Jesus called himself the bridegroom in Matthew 9, verse 15, Mark chapter 2, verses 19 through 20, and Luke chapter 5, verses 34 and 35. That's Matthew 9:15, Mark chapter 2, verses 19 through 20, and Luke chapter 5, 34 and 35. All right, and then John the Baptist called Jesus the bridegroom in John chapter 3, verses 28 through 30. And then in Romans 7, 1 through 4, Paul says we've died to the law and are married to Christ by the new covenant. In that passage, what he describes is us having died to the law, and he describes the law as being like an old husband. He says the old husband's dead, and by virtue of the new covenant, we're married to Christ. 2 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 2, he says, "For I have betrothed you to one husband that I may present you as a chaste virgin to Christ." All right, now we want to look at just a few characteristics of the church as his bride. And if you'll note in your notes, for those of you who want to do it, we have a little assignment for you, and that's to find some of the scriptures which verify these points that we're going to talk about. All right? It's good to get you digging in there and looking, but that's just for those of you who want to do it. All right, A, the first characteristic is that the bride is in union with the Lord, joined to him, and one flesh. B, the second characteristic. Okay. A, she's in union with the Lord, joined to him, and one flesh. In a metaphorical sense. All right, B. Another characteristic of the bride that we find in the New Testament is that she has made herself ready. Another characteristic of the bride that we find in the New Testament is that she is nurtured, cherished, loved sacrificially and unconditionally. D, we find that the bride of Christ is provided for. She's a kept woman. In other words, have you ever? I have these really funny pictures that come to my mind sometimes. I think God just has a good time winding me up. But he did give me that picture one time when I was worrying about something, some sort of provision. And he said, the bride of Christ is a kept woman. I'm your sugar daddy. And I was like, but it did kind of give me an idea, you know, because the picture that you have of a kept woman is, you know, it's like her every desire is fulfilled because she has this guy that just loves her so much and he just wants to shower all these gifts and presents and things on her. And God was just saying, my heart's like that. You don't see me that way, but that's the way my heart is towards you. I want to shower blessings on you. All right. E. She's a bride wearing combat boots. Do you want me to explain this one? I'll give you a hint. Go to the book of Ephesians. Ephesians portrays the bride as wearing combat boots underneath her beautifully white dress. All right, F. In the New Testament, we see that the bride is an overcomer. G, we find as we study the New Testament that the bride is pure and holy and righteous. H, we find references to the bride being glorious. She is glorious. And I, the last one under this section, we find that the bride is lovingly submitted to Christ. Okay, now there's more. That's just a few. We just hit some of the highlights. I'm sure you can come up with a lot more. Let's go on to part three. We want to look at the calling of the bride, specifically the calling to intimacy and rulership. Those are like the two key things as we study the passages that talk about the bride. Those are like the two key callings as the bride. And there are a couple of quotes here that were just really good that we put in your notes from a book called Destined for the Throne by Paul Bilheimer. We'll let you read through those later. But they were just really good and just right along the lines of what we're talking about. And so we wanted to just put those in there for you. Now, the first calling of as the bride that we want to talk about is that of intimacy. And it's characterized by passion, longing, seeking, and a joyful sharing on the part of both. Now, for a lot of years, I knew that God wanted me to be seeking Him and longing after Him and passionate about Him. and that I was supposed to share the deepest part of myself with him. But for a lot of years, I didn't realize that God intended for his side of the relationship to be characterized by those things as well. I didn't realize that he was passionate about me, that he longed for me, that he sought after me, and that he joyfully wanted to share every part of who he was with me. And what changed all that was I had a dream one night. I told Dave I wouldn't tell any stories, but I'll just tell this one, since the one last week went on so long. But what changed all that for me was I had this dream one night that was so vivid, it was like a vision, and it was like being in this thing, and it just changed my whole life. And I was like at a ball or something, and all these people were there, and they were dancing, and I was just sort of standing there, and then there was Jesus across the room. And in this dream, he just looked at me, and it was like his eyes just locked on to me. And there was this just like a locking on thing, you know, like in what's the spaceship things? The Star Trek kind of thing. You know how that beam locks on somebody and then they're just... That's what it was like. I was just frozen with my eyes locked onto his. And then it was like everybody in the room just sort of backed away and made room, you know, like royalty was coming and everybody sort of stopped dancing and backed away and he started walking towards me and I was thinking, well, there's all these beautiful women in the room. Why does he want me? But it was like I knew he did. And he had no eyes for anyone else except me. And then he came and he took me in his arms and we just danced. And it was like everything in my life just faded. And all I was aware of was him. And I woke up with my life totally changed. And I can't even put into words the way that dream was. Because it's beyond words, it's beyond description. I just know that something on the inside of me changed from that day on, and I knew that he was passionate about me, that he longed for me, that he sought me, and that in his God kind of way, nobody else in the world mattered but me. But then for you, he can be exactly the same way because he's God. You know, it's like with Douglas, you know, nobody else in the world matters but Douglas, but it's that way with Simon too, you know, because he's God and he can do that. But he can love each one of us so intensely and so passionately that it's like no one else in the world matters. His eyes are locked onto ours. And that whole revelation that came from that dream has just totally transformed my life and my walk with God and brought me to a new understanding of what it means to be his bride. All right. I wanted to just read, speaking of intimacy here, something from the Song of Solomon. And this is from chapter 3. This is verses 1 through 4. And this is the young Shulamite girl speaking now. She says, "By night on my bed I sought the one that I love." Remember, we were talking about this intimacy being characterized by a passion and a longing and a seeking after the other. And she says, "By night I sought the one I love. I sought him, but I didn't find him. I will rise now," I said, "and go about the city. In the streets and in the squares, I will seek the one I love. I sought him, but I did not find him." the watchmen who go about the city found me, and I said to them, have you seen the one I love? And she was actively searching for him. She didn't just wait for him to come to her, but she went out looking for him. And then she said, scarcely had I passed by them, the watchmen, when I found the one I love, and I held him and would not let him go. I found him and I would not let him go. And I think that's the kind of passionate seeking that the Lord has for us. When he finds us, he won't let us go. But by the same token, he hopes that we will passionately seek him. And when we find him, we won't let him go. All right, Isaiah 62:5 says, as the bridegroom rejoices over the bride, so shall your God rejoice over you. And then we have another little assignment here for those of you who want to do it. And that's to search out some other references to the passion and the longing and the seeking that God intends to be part of our relationship with him as the bride. Okay, we just mentioned a couple here, Song of Solomon and Isaiah 62. But for those of you who are longing and seeking, and here's an opportunity to just search out some other references to the kind of passionate relationship that he intends to be part of our relationship with him as the bride. All right, and then D, we just want to mention that passionate communion with him is in evidence today through prophetic songs, words, poems, dance, etc., etc. Now, I'll give you some examples to maybe clarify what I mean here. There's a communication that takes place between the bride and the bridegroom. And through the Old Testament, you find that one of the results, the prophets were always saying the results of their idolatry and their apostasy and their disobedience and their sin and their adulterous relationship with the Lord. The result of that was that the voice of the bride and the voice of the bridegroom would no longer be heard in the land. All right. Now, I think that was just a Hebrew expression that was referring to a time of devastation coming. People would not be joyfully celebrating their marriages anymore because there would be so much devastation going on that there wouldn't be any joy. But I think that God has a little deeper meaning to that. I think he was also saying that the voice of the bride and the bridegroom, his people and him, that communication would be cut off. The voice of the bride and the bridegroom communicating would no longer be heard in the land. But part of the restoration and the redemption that is now part of our inheritance is that the voice of the bridegroom and the voice of the bride, we hear the voice of the bridegroom and the bride now. There's communication between Christ and his bride. And we hear it coming forth in prophetic words and prophetic songs and in all the time. There was a song that used to be just make me weep every time I heard it. And the words went like this. To know you, to know you is the cry of my heart. Spirit, reveal him to me. To hear what you're saying brings life to my soul. To know you alone. That's the voice of the bride crying out to her bridegroom. And then, you know, whenever God speaks to your heart and says things like, you know, oh precious one, why are you worried and troubled over these things? Don't fear. That's the voice of the bridegroom to his bride. The voice of the bride and the voice of the bridegroom are now again heard in the land. God's restored that. He's restored that intimacy. So, anyway, all right. Then a second, this is number two under intimacy. Ooh, I have to hurry. I want to read to you Ephesians chapter 5, verses 23 through 32. But I want to start out by reading the last verse, okay, of that passage. Paul ends all of this passage with saying, "This is a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ in the church." All right, so keep that in your mind as I read this. Everything I've said before this, I'm really talking about Christ in the church. It says, "For the husband is head of the wife, as also Christ is head of the church, and he is the Savior of the body. Therefore, just as the church is subject to Christ, so let wives be subject to their own husbands in everything. Husbands, love your wives, just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for her, that he might sanctify and cleanse her with the washing of water by the word, that he might present her to himself, a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that she should be holy and without blemish. So husbands ought to love their own wives in their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself, for no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes it and cherishes it, just as the Lord does the church. For we are members of his body, of his flesh and his bones. For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. This is a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ and the church." There's a couple of key things in this passage regarding our relationship with Christ as his bride. One is that he nurtures, cherishes, and lays down his life for his bride. Now, that's nothing new to us. Another is that it talks about Christ being the head of the church. And I want to just elaborate on that for a minute, because this might be new to you. The Greek word there, head, is the word kephale. And I've done some intensive research on this, and most people think, kind of with a surface reading, that this, when you say head, that what it means is the head, like the one who's dominant or the one who makes decisions or tells the other person what to do, or that it has some sort of sense of rulership or authority. The word means absolutely nothing like that. It refers to like the headwaters of a river, like the source of where a river begins as a spring, springing up out of the ground. It really refers to source or source of life. The one who gives life to another. And so Christ, as our head, is the one who is our source, the one who gives us life. All of our life, all of our strength, all of our being emanates from him as our head. That's what the word kephale means. All right, and then number three, under intimacy, we find that it also involves union or communion or becoming that one flesh that he talked about. The two shall become one flesh. In other words, what's mine is yours, and what's yours is mine. And out of this arises the whole doctrine of the divine exchange. We give him all our junk. We give him our ashes and we get his beauty. We give him our mourning and we get his joy. We give him our sin and we get his righteousness. We give him our carnal nature and we get his nature. And so on. So in this relationship with Christ as his bride, there is no prenuptial contract. What's his is ours, and what's ours is his. For all of eternity. All right. You have a scripture here, John 17:21. Do you remember this is where Jesus was praying? And he talked about, Father, you know, let them be one as we are one, and we're in them and they're in us, and I'm in you and you're in me, and we're all in each other. And there's this picture of unity and oneness there that Jesus was describing. That's the kind of union and communion that we have with him as the bride. There's a oneness. We've become one flesh. Do you know, have you ever heard people say, when they've been married like a long time, that they've started to look like each other? I've heard people say that. I mean, I've never actually thought that myself, but I have heard people say that, you know, that they actually begin to look alike after they've lived together for 40 or 50 years. And maybe it is that we just sort of unconsciously begin to take on one another's mannerisms and things. But think about that in our relationship with the Lord. When we have that kind of union and communion with him, then we begin to look alike. I want to look like him. How about you? I'll take that one. All right. And then 1 Corinthians 6, verse 16 says, he who unites himself with the Lord is one with him in spirit. Talks about that union with him, that being one flesh. Okay, and then finally, we have the aspect of rulership, the calling to rulership as the bride. A joint heirs is more than just sharing in his nature and character. We talked about that last week. But it's also sharing in his dominion and authority. Sharing his throne and his glory. It's also sharing in his dominion and authority. Sharing his throne and his glory. The King of Kings will have a queen at his side ruling and reigning with him. That's the picture we get in the New Testament. And I'll just give you a few scriptures here that you can look up. One is Luke 12:32, where Jesus said, it's your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. John 17:22, Jesus was praying and he said to the Father, he said, the glory that you have given me, I have given them. We share in his glory as the bride. Ephesians chapter 2, verses 5 and 6 says, he's raised us up and we're seated together in the heavenly realm with Christ Jesus. Judicially and legally, we are already seated with him. Now, walking it out experientially is another matter. Revelation 3:21 says, to him that overcomes, I will grant to sit with me on my throne, even as I also overcame and am sitting with my Father on his throne. And we get the picture of, you know, the King of Kings with his queen seated next to him on his throne, ruling and reigning with him to those who overcome. 1 Corinthians 6, verses 2 and 3, he says, "Do you not know that the saints will judge the world? Don't you know that we shall judge angels?" There's again another picture of that calling to rule and reign with him as his bride. And finally, just the last thing you have in your notes, God is working, orchestrating, and weaving circumstances and events together now to prepare and train the bride.